Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Wednesday, November 26, 2025. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Walpin, who scribes for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other fine publications. Rob Pedrero writes for PC Magazine, Fast Company, and other fine publications. And good old John Quain, who writes for, John, what do you write for? New York Times, a small publication?
AARP, things like that, yeah.
A lot of
an up-and-comer.
He hasn't published any articles yet, but we're hoping that his first article gets published. This is right before Thanksgiving. How are you guys doing?
Very good.
Travel's out of the way. I'm relieved to have that done with.
So, Rob, because you had did you drive to Boston or did you fly?
No. I would not be looking quite as even-keeled as I do. No. Short flight. The time it took to get from the airport to my brother's house was a large fraction of the flight time from D.C.
And John?
Oh, I'm back in New York, but I'm going to travel again this weekend. And you remember, Rob, you have to get home too, so you still have to travel.
Right. Well, flying that way too. Somebody else is doing the driving, not me.
Okay.
Boston to Washington is what, 6 hours, maybe?
It's more like eight, but on this weekend, no.
Yeah.
How much do you like looking at brake lights on the Jersey Turnpike?
Yeah.
And Stuart, you're celebrating the Beatles, apparently, with the shirt.
Yes, the anthology on Disney Plus starts tonight, so I've got my Beatles shirts. I've got a Rubber Soul t-shirt. I've got a Revolver t-shirt. And I've got an Abbey Road t-shirt. I'm all set for the revived anthology on Disney Plus. Tune in today.
I might get roped into going to see Wicked 2 for good. I saw the first one. The first one was quite good. So we'll see if they could replicate the magic. But beyond that, let's get into our topics today. Mm. And this will be a really interesting one. how we approach this. You know, the stock market obviously has gone up quite a bit over the last couple of years, mainly, not only, but in large part because of this AI fuel that's fed the market. The market's gone down, it's gone up, but there are people who are now raising questions whether there's a bubble or not. Now, NVIDIA, you know, if you look at the three or four companies that kind of are good indicators of the health of AI, NVIDIA, you know, reported a blowout quarter, and they actually, and even their future quarter, they guided to is it's a big, big number. Now, I'm sure you guys are going to bring up the question is that the hardware itself, there's no question is corporate America has bought into this whole AI model, and the data centers are being upgraded. We can go into that in some detail on a different podcast. The real question is the demand going to be there from an application standpoint? I really think that's the question creating this kind of if not, maybe a bit of skepticism, whether there's really a market for all this stuff. So let me throw that first question to good old Stuart.
Well, I've always thought that the chatter about an AI bubble was just completely ridiculous because we are still in the beginning stage of this. This is nowhere near being a mature technology yet. As some AI pundits have noted, that AI is still as dumb as a cat. So there's still a long way to go, and I think a lot of companies are sort of waiting to get into it only because it isn't mature yet. It can't do everything that everybody is afraid that it's going to do. But in terms of there being an AI bubble that can be self-created by investors or whatever, yesterday, New York Mets owner and very influential hedge fund operator Steve Cohen made huge double-down investments in AI, including, for some reason, he would know, both NVIDIA and a huge investment in AMD. And apparently a lot of people on Wall Street are looking at that, and other people putting their money where their mouth is, where this is concerned, where there are continuing to be high-level investments. And with these high-level investments, it's very hard to figure out where this bubble is, since there is still so much room for growth in both adoption and what the chip makers themselves are doing to advance it. The Apple M5 chip is their AI chip, so, and they're still bringing out product for that. So I don't see where the bubble is.
Well, there's no history of Mets owners ever overspending on talent, so that's great.
No, not at all. What?
That's funny. That, you know, that's the funniest line in 2025 so far. But, well, Rob, here's a question for you, though, is that you're now starting to see a lot of reports, even though the job market numbers were pretty good. They were actually exceedingly good if you look at what expectations were, especially in the Bay Area. And there was just HP, they announced a big layoff this morning. And
Apple.
Yeah, and at Apple, yeah. They although I think their numbers were a bit more modest. I guess the question really is that is the best sign, this is really kind of a crazy observation, the best sign that AI is getting traction in corporate America is that they're laying people off, meaning that they're adopting those systems and they can get rid of people. And so
to look at it. There's two things people mean when they say AI. One is models that are designed for a particular task. Like apparently this year, the DeepMind model Google applied for hurricane forecasting did fantastic, much better than the National Weather Service's traditional model. And that's a case of something that is designed for one task. All this model knows about is weather patterns in the Caribbean. It doesn't care about anything else, and it's great at that. And then you have the open-ended AI chatbot thing that OpenAI is trying to make business out of, as is Anthropic, as is everybody else, Google. And yeah, the case for that we're going to have super intelligence, to use that phrase Mark Zuckerberg the buzzword Zuckerberg loves to throw around, that is very much not proven. And it seems to me OpenAI's valuation is assuming that it is proven. And meanwhile, are they actually making money? No, they are not. Very much not.
John, what's your thoughts along those lines?
Well, I asked Claude AI, of course. And the Claude AI thought the situation was very precarious. Yeah. This version of AI, whether it is neural networks or large language models, absolutely there's a bubble there. Oof, you know, because the technology is not going to get much smarter. It's as smart as a cat, and it's not going to get much smarter. You can throw a lot of data at it, but it's not going to get much more intelligent. To Rob's point, that was true with Deep Blue, right? Those neural networks were really good at narrowly defined specialty subject matter. Making it general knowledge kind of one like they're trying is not going to work with neural networks, and it's not going to work with large language models. And you're going to see model collapse because most of us are generating, or some of us are generating things using AI, and AI is now feeding on itself. That's the only data that it's getting with these large language models. It's not getting anything else. It's not getting into scholarly databases. It's not getting into deep, deep knowledge databases. So I think there's a bubble for that. The question really is, though, all that investment in the hardware, I don't think it's just going to go poof like the internet bubble. And it could be that someone else develops a better model, something that could produce some kind of general intelligence, some general AI. And if that happens, you could sort of pick up from where these things leave off. But are these things going to get better? Absolutely not. They are just inherently limited. The technology is inherently limited. Will you see some applications? It's great for me. I can get it to make pie charts, you guys. I hated doing that stuff before. I'm like, okay. I can ask it, you know, make a 3D chart with this data. But beyond that, it's really not proven itself anywhere. You know, specialty tasks are exceptions.
Yeah, I agree with that observation. I will say that, first of all, whether we like it or not, because I track the category very closely, right, the infrastructure is coming. Whether we like it or not,
right,
the big tech companies, the carriers, the OEMs of the different persuasions out there, they're putting the infrastructure in. So it's kind of like, I'm going to use a Stuart Walpin reference, Dwight Eisenhower and the National Highway Act in the 1950s. We don't know what the highway system is going to work out, but yeah. we're going to spend, back then it was like billions of dollars,
right,
to link the East Coast to the West Coast. And as you know, over the ensuing 25 or 30 years, there were cities that cropped up. There was infrastructure that cropped up. And I think that's the lesson of history, by the way. Every time there's been some type of, call it the railroads, even telecommunications, I mean, that there tends to be a latency effect, but it does lead to some type of economic growth. The question is the job displacement going to be real severe? That's the real question.
Well, here's where I have to bring up this really interesting story the Wall Street Journal ran the other day, pointing out how Meta is having a $27 billion data center constructed in Louisiana, financed with debt, and this is the lead of it. Neither the data center nor the debt will be on its balance sheet. The outcome looks too good to be true, and it probably is. It's some weird structured finance game that really, it doesn't actually use the phrase collateralized debt obligation, but it reminds me of the stuff that went really sideways around 2008. And you have to wonder what these investors are thinking, given that Meta has not been such a good judge of where the technology world is heading. So here we have a case where, yeah, the infrastructure is getting built, but here it's more like Mark Zuckerberg is Tom Sawyer getting other people to paint the fence.
I don't know. We'll just end on this question. I'm going to ask the three of you. It doesn't feel like 2000. I mean, 2000.
No.
Was, I mean, listen, there were kind of startups. Even without,
we see who buys Super Bowl ads.
Well, listen, I was right smack in the middle of that bubble, and it certainly does not feel like 2000. But I think one of the other sticking points here is the power usage. Apparently, these data centers use an enormous amount of power, which is driving up or helping to drive up a lot of consumer power prices, only because there isn't enough available power, electricity generation, to get these data centers all powered. And so they're going to have to find some solution to ease that off, because a lot of companies are going to back off, or a lot of states are going to back off from hosting some of these data centers. I know some state, and I'm just brain farting, but some state just said, no, we're not putting a data center in, because they don't have the power support for it.
Yeah. I can guarantee that will be an issue in Virginia when the General Assembly reconvenes in January, because we have the world's largest collection of data centers, concentration of data centers in Northern Virginia. They are using up a lot of electricity now. They'll use up more, and there is no realistic strategy to provide power for them. And if you're an individual voter, taxpayer, ratepayer, what is the upside for having these gigantic structures filling up more and more of the countryside in Prince William County and Loudoun County? There isn't any.
Yeah, there's also this circular, I think it does feel like 2000. I was thinking about this. So there's this circular investment going on here. So NVIDIA basically subsidizes OpenAI.
Yeah.
And that is kind of a problem. And if you consider that also the spending has exceeded consumer spending in the United States, so it's driving the economy suddenly. And you've got this sort of, you're paying each other the money, and somebody's going to notice, wait a second, that's the same money. That could easily pop that bubble really quickly. So it does. And in 2000, everybody's like, the internet, it's so cool, you can do anything with it. And that's kind of the feeling now. AI, it's so cool, you can do anything with it, you know?
John, the difference is in 2000, the bubble burst really quickly with not a lot of warning.
Right.
And there's been steady drumbeat. Oh, it's coming. Sort of like a couple of years ago when everybody says, oh, we're going to get this huge recession, and it never happened. So a lot of this, for the internet bubble bursting in 2000, was like suddenly, you're right, everything is great. And then suddenly it wasn't. Where this, there's this, all these predictions, and nothing, no bubble has burst yet. So that's why it feels different for me, because in 2000, it was great, 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 doink.
Yes. Well, in 2000, we have some stories, some mutual. Stuart and I were involved in one place, and I got something in the mail that said my health insurance had ended. And I'm like, Which company? What?
all of them.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, you're right that people are talking about it, whereas they weren't really talking about it in 2000. They just thought, no. You know. But we'll see. We'll see. Anyway, sorry. Yes,
no,
Spain.
No, no, no. It's going to be interesting. It just doesn't, no, again, I have no data to support this. It just doesn't feel like 2000. But I could be wrong. The market collapses next week and...
thank you.
This is a really, really important topic because, you know, this space stuff is starting to get back on people's radar. You pointed out in our pre-podcast exchange of what we're going to talk about this week is this whole kind of, I think the phrase you use, the phrase war game or this, I mean, you were using a militaristic term. Right? Let me put it that way. SpaceX versus Blue Origin. I mean, they all, you know, they each had different personalities. I think that reflects their ownership or their leadership. But give me your feeling of where this goes. There was a successful launch just a couple of days ago prelude to the Mars mission, which is, isn't that the Mars mission scheduled for 2027?
Well, if we're talking what Elon says, we got to preface everything with Elon says a lot of things. The top line view here is what had previously been an exceedingly one-sided competition in which SpaceX is the dominant launch provider around the world. Like, they have so far this year launched the Falcon 9 rocket more times than the space shuttle ever flew over 30 years. But Blue Origin, which for the past 10 years has been mainly known for little suborbital flights. They sent Jeff Bezos to the edge of space, William Shatner, and they've been working on their giant New Glenn rocket and seem to be doing that in the slowest possible way imaginable. Launched the thing at the start of the year, and they actually achieved orbit in the first time, which is really hard. SpaceX needed 4 tries to do that with its Falcon 1 rocket. Rocket Lab, I think, needed 3 tries. In terms of other countries in the West that have built a rocket of their own design, no government money, sent it from the ground to orbit on the first try, I think the number is 1, and it's Blue Origin. Last week, they launched New Glenn, their heavy lift rocket, for the second time, and they landed the first stage on this drone ship offshore. Yes. Nailing that on the first time is really impressive. SpaceX needed a bunch of tries to do that, and they've now made it look routine and boring. And so what had looked like a one-sided competition is now very much, there's a race going on, and NASA has taken note because NASA had hired SpaceX to adopt the upper stage of SpaceX's giant Starship rocket as a lunar lander to return American astronauts to the moon. That's falling further and further behind schedule. The Chinese are working on landing their own astronauts there for the first time, and they're not trying any breakthrough rocket architecture or anything. They're doing this in a slow and steady way, and they're going to devote unlimited resources to it. And the Chinese space program is itself really good. You know, forget about Russia is very much a third place player in space. It's the US and China, and then Russia is really falling further and further behind. So NASA wants to reopen the contract to give Blue Origin a chance to build a lunar lander that maybe that will be the first one that American astronauts fly to the surface of the moon. And of course, Elon Musk has taken it with his usual statesman-like grace. He had like a day-long meltdown calling acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy, Sean Dummy. I don't work PR, but I don't think that's a good way to ever, that's not good customer relationship management. Yeah. So interesting stuff going on. This is a fun field to cover.
But Stuart, the dream that everybody wants to get to, obviously, is a manned landing on Mars, which is you think the problems were complex putting men on the moon. The problem of putting men on Mars, I wouldn't say it's infinitely more complex, but there are challenges that they didn't have to deal with putting a man on the moon. I mean, essentially, it was a 3-day trip out there and a 3-day trip back. Yep. And that was, even with 1960s technology, which had to be innovations there. Remember Tang? Remember freeze-dried food? But, especially with the propulsion systems of technology that exists today, not warp engines that they have in Star Trek, it's going to be a big, complex challenge. And we were just talking about AI. having AI as a tool to run the simulations billions and billions of times to be able to test different scenarios, that's got to be an interesting application. We don't hear much about that, but I got to believe that that plays a big role, frankly, in the planning of a mission.
So well, you have to understand that that journey to Mars is geometrically more difficult than going to the moon. I mean, at one point, the theory was that we would get back to the moon and then use the moon as a launching point to Mars, because you would save so much in terms of having to build a huge booster, which you won't need to blast off from the moon because the gravity is so much less. So the thought was that you would first get back to the moon and build some sort of launch base there and then launch from there to the moon. That just seemed to make a lot more sense. And the fact that that Musk wants to go directly to Mars makes that, again, infinitely more difficult. Now, the race between SpaceX and Blue Origin, they both have contracts with NASA for varying stages or varying Artemis missions. Musk is really the only one who's talking about Mars. I don't know that NASA is even looking at that from an operational point of view right now. I think right now they're really focused on the Artemis missions to the moon, in which both SpaceX and Blue Origin have already contracted for major roles in that. So I think NASA is still really looking at, let's get to the moon first and then launch from the moon because that'll be easier, as opposed to Musk plan on doing the Starship and going directly from here to Mars, which is a lot more difficult both technologically, logistically. As we saw in the Martian, we could strand somebody there.
Oh yeah.
Bring lots of potatoes.
John, let's be honest with each other. I mean, just getting back to the moon, since the last time we went to the moon was 1972, I kind of look forward to that. And that's obviously happening in a very short-term window. I think they have the moon landing, another moon mission has been, I think, 2 years out. 3 years out, if I'm not mistaken.
Realistically, the earliest it could happen is 2028. There's a bunch of other stuff in the critical path, not just SpaceX. You know, this whole, on the original plan, we would have done that like 10 years ago. But the Artemis program in general, and especially the Space Launch System rocket that NASA has had built to its design, has not gone well.
Well, and John, the reason why I want to see this happen in my lifetime, all of our lifetimes, the advances in computational photography has been so unbelievable since 1972. I want to dispel once and for all, Stanley Kubrick did not fake the moon mission landing in the studio, which apparently is a thing, you know, so.
Yeah, certain celebrities who shall be nameless. I think there's a lot of value to getting to the moon and a lot of different things that could be done. Putting a station there would be, I think, the next step, especially with the International Space Station, scheduled to decompensate, as it were. Maybe that's the next thing to do. I was curious about the impact of meteors on the surface of the moon, which also really reminded me of how vulnerable it is. So I wondered how much that might be susceptible to impacts like that, because there was a Japanese amateur astronomer who actually captured two recent impacts very close together, and they were not insignificant. So it's like, right, if we build something and situate it there, that represents quite a problem. And the propulsion systems have fascinated me, as Stuart mentioned, too. And always talking to researchers about those propulsion systems and what could possibly get us to Mars, a compact nuclear one, ion drives, things like that, that people are working on would be interesting.
Solar wind.
Like that. Yeah. Could do, but let's get to the moon first again, like after we did that rickety. When you think about what we saw originally, it was such a rickety operation, you know? It was like a Volkswagen Bug going to the moon.
No, I think you're right. I mean, not so many people understand the details. I mean, first of all, when they landed the initial mission, when they landed in July of 1969, and Rob will correct me on this, I only think they were there for a couple of hours. You know, they were not. They were just happy.
It was overnight. They were only on the surface for a couple of hours. They were there overnight.
Yeah. But they're, you know, I think the engineer's philosophy was, hey, we landed now. Let's see if we can get these guys back.
Right, right. Yeah. It took multiple missions. Then they figured out we can somehow fit a car that folds up into the base of the lunar module. We'll drive around on that for a few days. And then it's still two guys living in a space that's, you know, not much bigger than, I guess, an office cubicle.
Yeah.
And then you can have, what was the astronaut's name? Alan Beans. Didn't he bring a driver with him? He had a golf ball off
the. No, that was Alan Shepard.
Alan Shepard, yes. But Alan
Beans. Alan Shepard.
Apollo astronaut. He went on to become a very good painter, painting impressionist pictures of the moon.
Yeah. Well, getting back to Earth here, let's talk about an issue to wrap this up. You know, Stuart, actually, I think you sent me the, I'll tee this up with you first. You know, the lots and lots of rumors that the Apple may change their cadence for announcing iPhones next year. You know, if you kind of deep dive into this issue, of course, this is all rumors. Apple hasn't confirmed any of this yet. But I really do believe that if you were a betting man, they're gonna announce a foldable phone next year, which, by the way, will be good news for Samsung because the category has been still very small. And I think Apple will validate the category. There was a story that I read on Apple Insider the other day that Apple apparently has solved the crease problem. I don't know if you
guys have heard that story. I saw that.
Yeah, and what's ironic, Samsung is going to supply the phone. Supply this to me. Again, we don't even know what the validity to that is, except the fact that Apple will care very much about the quality of the fold. Their story is not going to be, hey, you could fold the phone in half. Their story is going to be, hey, by the way, you don't see a crease. This is a great experience. But I guess the question for you, Stuart, is do you believe that the fold concept or the fold category is becoming so significant for Apple next year, they just can't bow out another year? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Samsung has been passed in the foldable. I believe that either Xiaomi or Oppo has passed, Huawei has passed Samsung in the foldable race. Samsung has fallen from the top, which it had a dominant share of for a long time, down below the Chinese makers. That's the first thing. So they will not be joining Samsung. They will be joining all the Chinese makers. And considering the Chinese makers are getting all of these advancements into Europe, especially Xiaomi more than Huawei, but certainly Xiaomi and Oppo are making their way deeper and deeper into European markets. Apple almost has to do a foldable simply out of defense. But we know that Apple refused to get into the foldable market until they could solve that crease process, that crease problem, because they did not want to come out with a Me Too product. They wanted to come out with something that was completely different. The second thing on this two-time-a-year thing also is based on a lot of the Chinese makers who have also begun to stagger their release schedule. So you're getting a lot of, for instance, Xiaomi just introduced its flagships, but are coming out with its ultra flagship sometime in either February or March. It might even be January because they're also competing with Samsung. So you're getting all of these companies. Motorola does its big foldable entry usually in April and May for the Razr Fold. So you're getting all these companies who are spreading out their release schedule while Apple remains nailed to that late September timeframe. The third thing is, remember that January of 2027 will be the 20th anniversary of the release of the first iPhone. And you can be sure that a lot of Apple's thinking on the staggered release schedule is so they can release something on the 20th anniversary of the first iPhone. Now, whether or not that will be the Fold or not, what I have heard from some of the analysts is that the Fold will come out in the fall of 27, and the spring time frame will be for the entry-level iPhones, the E version, And the entry level of whatever the iPhone 20, which will probably be that year, they're going to, the thinking is they're going to skip 19. So they'll have 18 next year. And then in 2027, they'll do Apple 20, which will be the anniversary. So the spring could see either spring of 27 could see the foldable or the two entry levels of the iPhone 20 or something completely different. But they definitely want to hit that date.
Yeah, so I think these are all, again, we don't know for sure because Apple doesn't telegraph any of this stuff. You find out when you find out. But here, John, here's the question for you, and I think we'll agree with this observation. You know, Apple, they even if they come out with the most beautiful foldable phone of all time, there's no crease, and they figure out the hardware to a level of perfection that people are, it's typical classic Apple, and people eat that up. I can't believe that's going to be Apple's only message. They have to present a, they have to present a foldable phone with compelling usage models that even Samsung hasn't conjured up or Google for the, by extension, because they make the operating system. So they've had a lot of time to figure out the operating system, the usage model portion of this. So what's your thoughts along those lines?
I don't think a foldable phone is going to be enough. I mean, if we're getting into the holiday season, how many of us now really feel compelled to buy the latest smartphone for a relative or, you know, a kid that needs a new phone? Nobody really, right? It hasn't really moved. Needle hasn't moved in a long time. I don't know that the foldable one will do it. I think Stuart's point about the 20th anniversary is interesting because I keep wondering about ambient computing replacing the phone. And Apple has this wonderful ecosystem and they push privacy, whether or not it's true or not, how private their conversations really are. But they do have this ecosystem. And I keep wondering, is this not the time to make that kind of a move to an ambient computing kind of environment? And that could be the next great thing. I don't know that another smartphone, even if it's a wonderful foldable phone, is really going to do it. It's not going to move the needle very much.
No, I agree with that. And that my point is there a usage model? Because I'll give you an example, a real basic one. You know, I just flew out to see my family out here in South Carolina, and I dragged my trusty MacBook Pro as well as my my 11-inch iPad. And I want to desperately want to be able to, when I travel, and I travel quite a bit, one less piece of hardware. And if I had a foldable phone, that in effect would, I wouldn't have to bring an iPad with me, you know, frankly.
Right. If I could unfold it to the size of a laptop to a 14-inch screen, now there you would have something, right? That would be awesome. but I don't know that they're going to deliver that.
We'll price on that, but that's a different story. But
yeah. Do you remember that episode of you probably guys didn't see it, but this episode of iCarly where the fat phone, it was when the first large scale, what do we call them? Fablets or something. Those large phones. And in iCarly, this kid show, they had this girl walking around with one that was like the size of like Encyclopedia Britannica, something, but there's definitely a use case for the traveling is a good one. You know, maps, there are lots of graphic things that we want. A bigger screen would certainly help. And I really feel that, there's a use case for them. Absolutely. I just don't know that that's enough to sort of generate the kind of hype but it also does make sense to go to not being locked into announcing a product, you know, a certain time of year. Televisions used to do that every April. I had to review like 50 TVs because they all came out at the same time. Automobiles every fall, we would drive them all summer long and then we'd have to review them all in the fall. None of that happens anymore. That's just all gone. And it makes sense to say, look, when you have something to show us, that would be the time to introduce the new product. And if you do it like twice a year, it gives you a lot more flexibility.
Yeah. And just to give Rob the last word on this topic before we wrap things up here. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about the foldable category, we all kind of tend to focus on when you open a foldable phone, you get a larger piece of real estate that you can watch. The way that Samsung and others have approached the category is there are, in fact, three screens. You've got two screens inside the phone because it's a candy bar like form factor, and you have another full screen on the other side. And I have not seen, I mean, Samsung's done, or call it Android, Google, they've done some kind of interesting things that you could have from an application usage model standpoint. But I suspect, again, you know, Apple's had a lot of time to think about this, and I have to believe they're going to bring some usage models for it that are not just as simple as the one that I outlined. That I want to have I want to have one less device. Remember, you know, Apple would love you to buy an iPad and a big iPhone if it was up there. But what do you think, Rob?
So I think what does make sense, what Stuart said about having one release time, I guess, in the spring for a budget model phone, then the other ones come out in the fall, which is what Google has been doing for several years now. With there'll be the high-end Pixel phones, and then the A series phones come out, I guess, like 6 months or so later, which are the budget models that dispense with some of the higher-end stuff and are a lot cheaper. That makes sense. Yeah, you've definitely convinced me Apple will do a foldable at some point. But yeah, what will make it different from everyone else, given you already have crazy stuff? Huawei has one foldable phone where there's three screens in addition to the exterior one. And we're starting to get into, like, how many blades can you put on the Razr? So how many screens can you put in the foldable phone? Right. So, yeah, I'm not sure what Apple will do, but I'm sure that when they introduce it, Tim Cook or whoever is going to be like, we waited until we could really nail this concept. Right. Exactly. How great we are.
No, I can always write. I can write the press release right now, and the way it's gonna be
writes itself.
Right. And I will say, before we wrap things up, Samsung sent me their Fold 7. It's a Fold 7, whatever the latest Fold that they announced. And I have to tell you, you know, it's a beautiful phone. Yes, there is a slight crease, you know, but not so bad that it's annoying. But to me, it's a usage model type of thing. You know, and I just feel, well, you know, and by the way, I'm in the Apple ecosystem, and for me to extract myself, that's a completely different discussion. Right. But I just have to believe that, you know, Stuart, I think you'd agree with that. I don't think Apple can stay out of this category too long. I mean, because at some point, people are going to say, you know, let me give this a shot. You know, let me, and like you said, there are other people jumping into the foldable category, but. Let's wrap things up there. I want to thank all of you again for coming in and bringing on the podcast just the 24 hours before Thanksgiving. Here's all my social media channels. You know, I want to report a nice thing that's happened. A couple of months ago, I got alerted from YouTube that the podcast has gotten more than 5 million views, which is something to celebrate. And I appreciate all the help you guys have been playing in that role. But please follow me on YouTube, on LinkedIn, on X, and on Instagram, believe it or not. And I want to thank all of you for your help on today's podcast, guys. And again, have a great Thanksgiving.